Well, a new audio documentary series was just released by Audible.com. It's a 6-part series that looks at the relationship between law enforcement and the black community, but not as much about where we are today, but how we got here.
In the mid-80s, crack cocaine and all the violence, addiction, and death it caused inspired a new phase in the war on drugs. It changed how and why police went after people and the rules that sanctioned it. It was at least the official reason for laws that declared crack 100 times worse than powder cocaine. Laws that began fast-tracking black men and women into prison cells, sometimes for life. With more aggressive policing, with cops across the country going almost military, yeah, the 80s ushered in a next-level reality for black America and the criminal justice system. Someone put it to me like this. That moment, 3 decades ago, it was like an earthquake in black neighborhoods. And they said, we're still picking through the rubble.
That's a snippet from the documentary called 100 to 1, The Crack Legacy. And in the series, it looks at the crack epidemic of the late 80s and the aggressive response from police and the criminal justice system. Is there a connection to how the black community is policed today? The producers try to give context to the debate that continues over policing in the age of Black Lives Matters. The production has Chicago roots, focusing some of the series here on the South Side with the story of Eric Wilson, who ended up with a life sentence for the first time crack offense. Joining me on the line from Brooklyn is the producer and host of 100 to 1, longtime journalist Christopher Johnson, and in studio in Chicago here, my former colleague Derek John, who is also a co-producer on the project. Christopher, Derek, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Christopher, let me start with you. I mean, I really enjoyed the series, and I want to ask, like, where it comes from. I mean, was this sort of like a question or a theory or a premise that was thrown out, and you went to sort of try to answer it?
Yeah, absolutely. First, I just want to say thanks for having us on your show. So the place, it began for me basically looking at Baltimore. I remember when Baltimore was responding to the death of Freddie Gray. Many of your listeners may remember the uprising there, some of the rioting and the fire and the looting and, of course, the protests. And I began to think about where all of that was coming from, because it felt like Baltimore and Freddie Gray's death was happening along with lots of other incidents of police brutality, police violence. And so I was trying to figure out what was the cause of that? And there are lots of answers to that. And I went looking for one answer in the history of the war on drugs and found an answer in the war on crack cocaine.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, was that sort of an anecdotal idea? The idea that, oh, you know what? I've always heard that it just kind of started with the crack epidemic, or was it something through your research that you sort of snaked back to say, oh, this is when we started to see more militaristic or more aggressive police strategy?
Well, it's a bit of my own personal experience. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area during the 80s. As anyone who remembers D.C. in the 80s, it was one of the half dozen cities that was really, really hurting badly under the so-called crack cocaine epidemic. And so there's always been this thing in my heart where I wanted to go back and look back at that time and research it. I mean, even our mayor became international news for smoking crack cocaine. So I wanted to see what that moment was all about. So that thing was always in my brain. I wanted to do something about what crack meant for DC. And then again, looking at what was happening with police violence today, I just started to think there may be some kind of a connection. And I was doing some research, and then Derek and I started to do some research and began to see threads of a connection. The deeper that we went, the more it began to flesh out, and the more we began to see an actual, a real connection, a strong connection.
Well, and let's bring Derek in. It's funny to think about it, because you're like, I've heard all of these stories, and when you piece them together in this documentary, this series, you really do get you paint a stark picture, especially when it comes to not just aggressive police tactics on the ground, but the criminal justice system and how, I mean, it's called 100 to 1. Why do you call it 100 to 1?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the most eye-opening things for me, I think. And you know, I grew up in the 80s as well, and I remember the crack epidemic, and you would hear about, you know, crack houses and crack babies, and it was all this sort of like media mythology around it. And when you really started to look at the actual legislation and the policy that was passed back in the kind of mid to late 80s under Reagan and then Bush, you get this like real tough on crime, draconian drug laws. And I mean, I just really had no idea, honestly, going back And you discover that there's a moment where, you know, we talked to this guy, Eric Sterling, who's like this legislative aide in the House at the time. And literally it's like, you know, in 2 months after the death of Lynn Bias, which was a big deal at the time, right? This basketball player who was drafted by the Boston Celtics, and it was a cocaine overdose, but everyone thought it was crack. And again, there are so many myths that permeate this whole story. But literally like 2 months after that, Congress rams through these laws, and we get the name of the series 100 to 1 after this one law that literally treated crack as if it was 100 times more dangerous than powder cocaine, even though chemically they're the exact same drug.
And that was, and that's sort of the theory, and that's this idea that, you know, it was, it had to do with the affluence, that powder cocaine was in one way or another was a party drug for Wall Street or for affluent kids. And if you were caught with some of that stuff, it'd be a slap on the wrist, or you can maybe get a good lawyer and get probation. But crack cocaine was tremendously, I mean, this was there was no way out of this. You were going to jail, and you were probably going to jail in some cases for life.
Oh, yeah. And you get these mandatory minimum laws that are passed that basically tie the hands of judges, and they're just forced to hand out these life sentences. And that's how we, you know, encountered the story of Eric Wilson on the South Side.
Let's talk about Eric Wilson. And Christopher, I mean, it's, I know Derek and I have worked at different times, you know, in Chicago in the news when we talk about the former police commander, John Burge. Eric Wilson sort of is right in that area, and it really, you guys focused and showcased his life, a life in which was put in jail for a life sentence for a first-time crack cocaine offense. It really, you know, based, I mean, the whole point of that is about trust. John Burge and what, the Midnight Crew, is that what it was called?
Mm-hmm.
The Midnight Crew,
that's right.
Sort of really doing some things to pull out confessions and other things that ultimately, you know, become, you know, lawsuits and a really dark time for the Chicago Police Department. Talk about that. Talk about Eric's story and how that plays into the narrative you guys are putting together about the relationship and between the community and the police.
Sure. I mean, Eric Wilson's story actually becomes this very interesting convergence of a lot of the topics that we were trying to cover in the 6-part series, in terms of both the war on crack cocaine and also police brutality, like times 1,000 with John Burge and the Midnight Crew and the police torture cases. Eric Wilson was a kid growing up on the South Side of Chicago, and he was born in the Robert Taylor Homes, and he pretty much from the beginning had been responsible for taking care of his family. His mother was quite young when she had him, and then she had his brothers and sisters, and much of taking care of the family kind of fell into his hands, because his mother was dealing with a cocaine addiction, and his father wasn't around very much. And so Eric was deeply dedicated to taking care of his family. You hear us repeat this over and over again in the episode about him, that take care of the family, protect the family, no matter what. So in Eric's case, Southside Chicago at the time, not unlike it is now, he tried to find work. He tried lots of different jobs. It wasn't working out. At the same time, the gangster disciples around him were saying, listen, we can help you get work. We can help you earn an income to take care of your family, take care of your brothers and sisters. It was selling crack cocaine. And prior to that, Eric had also been picked up by John Burge's Midnight Crew and had a hellacious experience with him and his cousin. Listen to the episode, and you can hear Eric talk about
so
that.
So you can already feel in the episode the lack of trust he has for the police after his run-in with Burge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and so what we tried to do is show this arc of Eric's life in terms of trying to find a way to take care of his family after his experience with John Burge, recover from that and the PTSD that he was experiencing as a result of that, and then got arrested for basically a drug conspiracy as part of the gangster disciples, and ended up getting a life prison sentence for a first-time drug offense.
What stands out about it? You know, and you go out of your way, and I appreciate that you do, Christopher and Derek as well. I mean, you go out of your way to say, we don't want to make excuses. You know, this isn't sort of like, hey, you know, this guy, you know, he really didn't mean to do it. I mean, he was selling crack cocaine on a street corner in Chicago. And that's important for the story because this is not a documentary or an audio series that's about saying that the police were wrong to try and crack down on drugs or people that were selling drugs.
Not at all. And I think, you know, let's be honest, you remember back to those years in Chicago and a lot of places in America. It was awful. There was terrible violence, a lot of gun violence, a lot of gang violence in the drug wars. I think what we were trying to do, though, was show how the response to that, maybe at the time everyone had the best intentions, but again, some of those laws were just divorced from reality.
And you talk to police officers in the
Absolutely.
Series and you talk about like they even reflecting back, they say we may have gotten too aggressive or maybe too militant in our response.
And certainly there was a real erosion in probable cause and other, you know, just sort of constitutional rights that, again, we try to show how that over time through either the laws, the way those laws were carried out by prosecutors, the police, essentially created this kind of climate, this kind of environment where you do have this very heavy hand of policing where you sort of shoot first and ask questions later, which, again, I think is where we have ended up.
Right. I mean, you even hear Eric say in the piece about him, I believe that people should pay for the crimes that they commit. He doesn't say that he didn't do anything wrong. It's a question of degrees.
Right.
And 100 to 1, I mean, even our title from the first episode to the last really tries to drive that home, that we're not making excuses. We're not trying to make excuses for anybody in this, in our kind of constellation of characters. It's just a question of degrees. And the 100 to 1, we felt really captured how extreme things felt like they got then. And so now looking forward 30 years later, if things feel a bit excessive and intense now with police violence and the way that people are experiencing policing in their neighborhood, there seems to be some kind of a connection for us.
I mean, it's interesting too, because this is, I mean, it's not a documentary. It's not about, you know, oh, the police. I mean, it's bigger than that. I mean, it's reflective of our society and what we value and when how we knee jerk to things and how everything that we do has consequences. And I think that kind of plays out in this series. And it seems like that is possibly the intention of what you're trying to put together.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, what we're trying to say is, and you hear this in the last episode, what we try to drive home is the sense that this is really up to all of us as members of society. I mean, we reflect in our last episode even on President Trump and on us not being exactly sure as he pulls together his administration, as the Attorney General really begins to consider the role of police and federal oversight of policing. We're still kind of seeing some of that rolling out. But at the end of the day, of course, we know that laws and that policy, they all have very strong influence on the way that we experience police and the way that police behave. But it's also the decisions that all of us as citizens of this country make in terms of what we will tolerate and what we think is okay in our society.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I think it was interesting during the campaign, you know, you might remember Hillary Clinton got a lot of flack for her super predator comment back in the day. And of course, the Clinton crime bill also kind of continued this wave of legislation after Reagan and Bush of, again, the sort of get tough, you know, more just extreme, like basically everything is punitive.
And we see Rahm Emanuel doing the same, pushing for the same kind of things here with the gun laws, mandatory minimums.
It's true. And look, Chicago in some ways is a special case in that, you know, things have gotten obviously really bad here and compared to the rest of the country. But by and large, you know, violent crime is at historic lows. And despite all that, you've got Trump coming in, you know, saying law and order. We're going to be ruthless. But I think I just wanted to just say, though, I think it's funny during the series, Christopher and I kind of kept having this debate. I kind of kept saying, like, well, gosh, you know, how do we get here? And he would say, no. Why does this keep happening? And it is true. And in some ways we look back, I mean, all the way. I mean, you can go really far back if you want to just see, again, this notion of black criminality and where these kind of stereotypes come from. It's deep. It's really deep.
Derek John and also Christopher Johnson, co-producers. Christopher Johnson, the host of 100 to 1, The Crack Legacy. You can find it at audible.com. It's a six-part audio documentary. Guys, it's great. Great work. I really enjoyed it. And thanks for taking some time out to talk to me tonight.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.